Hi everyone, welcome to our latest ILS NYC event broadcast. Please visit the website to see the details of our kind sponsors without who we couldn't put on this event, and also to view all of the video content which will be archived there for your viewing pleasure. So we continue to look at the development of the insurance linked securities market, always with one eye to the future, and this year we're focusing on the theme of defining the next generation of ILS and pulling on our industry contacts and industry experts to help us look forward, cast sort of a view in our crystal balls and see what's coming down the line. For this broadcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Tom Johansmeyer, head of PCS, part of the Verisk group of companies, and also PCS is our headline sponsor for this event. So thank you for that, Tom, and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Steve. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to talk to Tom. Tom's always got interesting opinions around the core area of the market where he operates, but also more broadly than that. Today we're going to sort of focus in on some of the areas where PCS has been so fundamental to the development of ILS, look at what Tom believes is coming down the line from that, and what industry participants should be prioritizing right now to ensure they can capitalize on the opportunities of the future. So to begin, Tom, I mean, one of the roles everyone knows PCS for is your catastrophe reports. I think I first encountered a PCS cat report back in 1995 or six. It's critical information to the industry in many ways, both on the market losses, and it helps people both in transactions and also in managing their businesses as well. And those industry loss metrics are increasingly featuring in risk transfer around cat bonds and ILWs and the like. And it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts first on the uptake of products using industry loss triggers and how you see that playing out.
It's interesting, as we always expected, Q4 in particular, coming into Q1, to be strong for the industry loss index product, the PCS product. Obviously, with uncertainty around the pandemic, several years of historical catastrophe events accumulating and developing over a period of years, concerns about how much new capital is coming into the market and what form, we expected robust use. I think, like a lot of folks in the retro market, we all had our hopes up here in terms of potential performance, and then there was enough new capital came in, and okay, maybe, it settled to where our realistic expectations should have been. Obviously, we see more momentum coming through this quarter and the next as well. It makes sense. When you've got uncertainty, when you've got potential capital constraints, when you've got concerns around loss development and reporting, industry loss index makes sense, right? You have to understand us. We reflect the market. We're clear, we're transparent, you don't have to worry about your counterparty. I think this is probably the biggest issue we've seen in terms of the move to index over the past couple of quarters, is that there's a greater understanding about the hidden costs of UNL or indemnity business. You hear a lot about frictional costs in a cat bond transaction, but the frictional costs involved in just taking a UNL transaction are non-trivial. And then they're made worse by the fact that you have kind of post-attachment efforts around, data collection, data transmission, reserving, updating your reserves, so forth and so on. It's a labor-intensive way to transfer risk. And I think that we've found through the course of taking advantage of the speed of both pre-deal and post-trigger, the transparency around our reporting, consistency of our methodology, it's just made a lot more sense, so that in markets like this, you'd usually see a certain amount of index take up anyway. I think we've seen people lean into that a bit more because the current conditions provide an opportunity, especially for protection sellers, to take advantage of an instrument that they really can put to work well. And for protection buyers, I think they've had to take a hard look at some of the barriers to index adoption in the past, like basis risk, and get a real understanding of how severe that is and how to manage it, rather than just knee-jerking to a UNL product that they've just always believed is better. But in fairness, I think without enough reflection and self-exploration on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that over the last few years, and obviously 2017 also saw this, the industry loss trigger and protection structured with an industry loss trigger has responded well to major events as well, which I guess has given some people some confidence or greater confidence in some areas. And there certainly seems to be a number of larger players that are beginning to sort of rely on this as part of their protection stack. And you speak to the simplicity of it as well, which is very true that obviously an ILW can be structured with very little paperwork compared to a cat bond, but a industry loss trigger cat bond can often be an easier task frictionally for people as well. How do you think things are going to develop over the sort of the next year in that specific marketplace? I know obviously retro has been demand down slightly perhaps, and ILWs haven't really seen sort of an explosion of growth, but the cat bond market seems to be driving quite a lot of appetite for more industry loss triggers.
No, it's interesting, right? You see cat bonds go up, ILWs not as much. To me, I just look at it as industry loss index triggered growth versus not, because obviously that's the business I'm in, right? I have to manage to that, and I see it as a significant lift. Before we take a look at the full year, let's carve it up a little bit, right? Let's carve up the next 2 months, the 2 months after that, then June, then the rest of the year, right? So the next 2 months, starting now, really, are about the 1/4s, the Japan renewal. So you mentioned 2017 a moment ago as driver of industry loss index. Yeah, obviously. Less obviously, but probably more transformationally, is 2018. Jebi, Trami, the floods. So what we found is that use of our Japan index went from, obviously, we launched maybe 2 months before the 1/4 in 2019. By the end of the year, I think we're up 500-600 million in limit traded against us. Last I heard, we're probably at about 800 million in Japanese ILW limit against PCS right now, with a couple of brokers saying that they expect it to be over 1.25 by the end of the year. So what's interesting is that actually constitutes overall market growth, not growth relative to PCS limit or ILW limit falling to zero because PCS wasn't in the market yet, with all like the Nat Cat and the Sigma issues in 2018-19. This could actually be taking what was prior to Jebi a $1 billion ILW market and taking another 25% onto that on an index that'll be 3 years old by the time it happens. I mean, that is unprecedented. That shows rapid market movement, and that shows clear expansion. We're also aware there were a couple of attempts. Oh, I don't want to say attempts, that sounds bad. There were a couple of efforts to include Japan in some 144As in 2020. Didn't work for a variety of reasons that had to do, I think, with pricing and structure and needs of the cedent. But we expect that we'll see the first one later this year, either private securitized or 144A. And what that tells you is that that entire corner of the industry loss index market is growing as well. So this is just kind of market cycle stuff. This is a shift in the foundation, if you will.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. Obviously, we've seen sort of multi-regional or multi-continent industry loss deals in the past, but adding Japan in there for the big global reinsurance companies is going to be a really efficient way for them to buy protection, you would think. But I can understand that perhaps the pricing may not always be the easiest thing to come to first time around.
Yeah, I think that, pricing is becoming more of a problem than trigger or data availability. Which, from my point of view, for running PCS, I take that as a positive. Because what does that mean? We're giving you the tools. The tools are widely accepted and respected. Now it's just a matter of finding a clearing price. I mean, whether it's a Japanese cat bond or a cyber ILW, both of which are encountering this kind of price mismatch issue, the one thing we're not hearing from the market is questions about the index and its credibility.
Well, that's positive.
Yeah, the index is good to go. We just need to find, you know, the right attachment point for a buyer and a seller.
Yeah, it also suggests, and this is something I guess we've seen beginning to accelerate in the last year, is protection buyers do seem to be getting a little more sophisticated, but at the same time, investors are getting much more sophisticated as well in terms of how they, what they're willing to accept and what their return hurdles are. And minimum return hurdles have clearly risen with the losses of the last few years and the pandemic as well. So I guess with these newer regions on the industry loss index, it's just going to take perhaps a little more time to find that clearing point.
Which is fine. I mean, I think it will take a little more time, but when you, I can't believe I'm saying this, but when you look at how fast our industry is moving right now, that's to be expected. You know, what I'm pretty happy about the team at PCS is we're taking the tools and bringing them to market before the market needs them, so that it is possible to take time, digest, understand a right clearing price, rather than 10, 12 years ago, where you would take, you know, data from the local newspaper, slap together a trigger and hope you don't, you know, wind up in arbitration later. You know, basically, you know, what we're saying is, here's the stuff. Take a couple of years if you need it. Learn about it now, kick the tires a little bit, which we're seeing. And when you're ready to trade, you're ready to trade. We're seeing that in the large risk loss index right now as well. Launched a little over a year ago, no trades yet, that's fine. We do know there's a fair amount of analysis going on in the market right now ahead of what we hope are a couple of ILW trades. What that means is, that, again, you know, overall growth to the market. Makes sense.
And that is a healthier way to embrace a new sort of trigger option, I guess, as well, instead of just trying to bring a deal to market and surprising everybody with something they don't understand. At least everybody gets a chance to absorb it, look at how it sort of how the data stacks up against their own data and their own portfolios, which should result in more healthy trading in future. Wouldn't be right to talk about industry loss triggers or any trigger without discussing basis risk a little bit as well, I guess, that perennial or long-lived issue around any trigger type that's not or that is unusual in some way to the industry. Do you think it's less of a focal point than it used to be as the industry is becoming more sophisticated in its use of data analytics, or do you hope it will become less of a focal point?
I have no hopes or dreams around basis risk, Steve. And nor would I. It is a simple fact of the instrument and a fact of life. Now, what I think is important is to understand how it manifests and what it potentially costs relative to other forms of risk. And I think we have to spend some time also thinking about how companies can either manage basis risk, accept basis risk, or realize where it's not that big a deal. You know, if you're looking at something pretty high attaching and you could either build a UNL structure that takes you all the way up with all the attendant, you know, effort and cost and pain associated with that, or say, look, you know what? Index this level, we know everybody's going to be blown, so that's fine. You know what? Why wouldn't you do something that's simpler, faster, and easier when that's the outcome you're hedging for? Yeah, I think industry loss has a place. I think UNL has a place. I think there are places for other structures as well, such as parametric. The issue isn't one being better than the other. It's an issue of constructing the right approach to risk and capital management. When it comes to basis risk, what I find disappointing is that you knee-jerk it as an industry, right? Well, we don't accept basis risk. Okay, so you accept counterparty data risk. You know, if you are, you know, reinsuring or worse, providing retro to another party, you know, you've got data issues there, you know, around trust, reliability, ease of gathering, speed of reporting. And the notion that these aren't big deals is insane. I know for a fact a lot of companies struggle over these, and a lot of companies will choose their counterparty and potentially even pay more to avoid those that can't work on the data side. You know, if I'm sending you data and you know what to do with it, you don't know what to do with it as a buyer, I have a problem in terms of how long it'll take to collect, how hard I'm going to have to fight, how much I'm going to spend in order to have that recovery. As a seller, if I struggle with the data you give me, then, you know, you're not the other side I want. You're going to come at me aggressively at some point, potentially, and that's going to cost me more to defend. You know, the kind of case study for the counterparty data risk in the retro market is probably the Florida reinsurance story we've been hearing since Irma. PCS has closed that estimate, but we know that, you know, UNL deals are still reporting. And what's the problem? You know, you've got early on, you get the loss advice, and a lot of reinsurers I spoke to were like, yeah, you know what, we get the loss advice, we tack 20 or 30% onto that, and then we double it. And a year and a half later, they're like, we thought that was going to be enough. Now, think about a UNL retro market where if you're getting any data, it's probably not going to be of the best quality. It's a big if. You're doing the same thing. So what does that do for, you know, productivity of your capital, you know, time and cost associated with the reserving effort? If you've got a small shop and you're hiring an outside, you know, actuarial firm to do that work for you, that's a direct deal expense. You know, it's at a certain point, you have to look at the cost of that relative to the cost of basis risk.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting because actually transparency in the industry causes basis risk to a degree as well, I suppose, in terms of asymmetry between parties and transactions. And and yeah, the retro point is a good one as well, because the flow of data down to the retrocession level has always been lacking. And I would hope that as that flow of data improves, which you would think transparency has to improve because people are going to force it through with technology over time in insurance and reinsurance, you would hope that actually enables retrocessionaires to hedge more effectively and to understand the potential for basis risk within a transaction much more effectively than they could previously.
Well, that's the role of industry data, right? I mean, if you've got, you know, issues with clarity, consistency, or transparency of your counterparty, if you move to an industry loss instrument, then you don't have to worry about that. But it means you need sufficient industry loss data in order to benchmark your experience to it. You know, you wind up working by proxy a little bit, which introduces some risk. I mean, the reality is transparency is fantastic. That is a fact, as long as it's the other guy doing it.
Yes, that's very true. So if we look sort of ahead, well, the future of sort of industry loss triggers and anything else you have in mind around triggers, anything you can reveal at PCS, what do you expect in terms of development over the next few years?
I mean, I think we're probably at the beginning of an adoption wave right now. You know, so obviously we've seen the standard market-driven uptick in US and Canada. We've seen some discussion around Mexico, particularly within the context of a US-Mexico cross-border transaction, the way we see in the cat bond and ILW market all the time for the US and Canada. That's obviously a matter of time at this point. Clearly, of course, there's going to be kind of the promotion of what we see in the PCS ILW market for Japan right now into the 144A market. That's also kind of a matter of time at this point. What's interesting there is you'll probably see a lot more Japanese risk unlocked into the cat bond market over time. So historically, there have been a handful of deals. They're the same handful of deals we always see. You know, they're done on an indemnity basis because that's all that's been available. And then in the kind of retro cat bond market, it's, you know, overwhelmingly US, Canada, right? I mean, just how it works. If we can see 144A parties getting comfortable with what's now, you know, kind of de rigueur in the ILW market, that sort of move could unlock a considerable amount of Japanese ILW style risk in the cat bond market, which would bring a nice influx of diversifying risk. So that's obviously on the trajectory as well, along with some of the other markets we're looking at. You know, we report in Latin America, for example, there's some potential there. You know, non-US Caribbean, likewise, some potential. And more, obviously, the specialty alliance market is going to come into the cat bond market, I think. And obviously, we've seen, you know, several years of marine and energy ILW trading That's an established market. It's working fine. We're seeing that expand into onshore right now with some of the conversations I mentioned a moment ago. And obviously, cyber is kind of lingering in the background as well. So we figure, I know I've been saying this every year at this conference now for a while, this is the year we're going to see the cyber ILW. I genuinely think we will. And what that could do then is kind of nudge the door on private cap-ons for that and other specialty classes, which I think provides an early step toward a broader platform for the cap-on market as well in terms of index-triggered risk, which honestly is going to be, if not a necessary precursor to UNL risk of that sort coming into the cap-on market, at least a complement. Because if you only have UNL type risk coming in for specialty, you're likely to see the same sorts of constraints you see in the Japanese cap bond market right now. Limited number of cedents who are presumably close enough to the risk under specific deal terms with limited opportunity to hedge on any other basis than UNL, which is in itself a slim market. So if you have a cap bond earned sector with an industry loss trigger, cap bond sector with UNL, for the same class of business, you could actually see more action come in on the UNL side because the people who are buying those cap bonds could then either lay off via ILW on an index basis, do their own private cap bonds in an index basis, or otherwise manage how they assume this risk on a UNL basis and optimize their use of capital by kind of taking the basis risk or moving with some differences around conditions or trigger points. So a healthier, more active capital management platform becomes available.
And that could be very interesting in areas like Japan, given the peak risk there of quake risk and cyber, given the size of the potential losses there and then the potential for capital to become extremely heavy on those risks if there are major losses. It seems hedging is just a matter of time. In cyber, I guess, do you think that the pandemic may have accelerated that and we may see more activity in sort of cyber risk hedging over this year because of the pandemic?
I'd love to say so, but honestly, the pandemic, I think, got in the way. I mean, time last year, we were working on what we thought would be the first cyber ILW. And then, you know, early onset of COVID led to increased uncertainty loads, which basically kind of priced the capacity providers out of the market. So I think that plus the ransomware state last year is difficult. And then inside that, you've got volatility in the cyber market. What I would like to see is one or two opportunistic trades just to show that it's possible, set a price, you know, get everybody a little bit of deal experience and save the big kind of hedging activity for later. Mm-hmm. I think what we need right now is an industry exercise so that we can establish some institutional knowledge around getting that sort of trade done. And I think there are other classes of business that could benefit from this as well. Because what happens if the big one comes, right? The Andrew of cyber, or, you know, the next 9/11 in the terror class of business, or you know, a multi-country $10 billion SRCC event. You have an unprecedented event with limited sources of data, no prior price reference, no experience around structuring, no brokers who have had the opportunity to really test out the story that goes with marketing and transaction like that. And basically, you're like, oh no, I've got a capital need. I've got capacity providers who are now terrified by a massive kind of industry-changing event, and we have no playbook. We have no template. Now, getting some of these done before you actually need it could mean that you're dusting off deal docs to kind of, can you know, find, replace the stuff you need to, rather than trying to build this stuff from scratch when you're under the gun and have potentially, you know, concerned or unavailable capital.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. I mean, if we look back at why the cat bond market came into being in the first place, it was because some of the big players recognized that the need for capital to support large events like Hurricane Andrew was going to be more significant than the industry could provide on its own. The ability to reload after those sorts of events was not going to be as easy. And cyber is certainly a class of business where if we do have the big one, the industry may struggle to get the capital that it needs to refill that class of business. I'm not sure the private equity investors would all be rushing to pour their money into reinsurers and reinsurers after a really world-changing cyber risk event. So opening up the capital markets would be a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if we think about sort of what else could change or be developed in your space, in the industry loss space, are you expecting people to become more advanced with their use of triggers, maybe to calibrate them more closely, sensitize them, things like the county weighted approach that we've seen in the past? And I guess do you also think we could see more dual trigger instruments that factor in industry losses as well?
I'm not sure how much of any of that we'll see with scale. And truth be told, I'm agnostic, right? I mean, in terms of, let's take county level triggering first. Obviously, yeah, I'd love to see more county level adoption simply because it's in my best interest, right? I mean, like everybody, you know, we all have an axe to grind in the industry. But more realistically, if that's not the trade the market needs, then the market shouldn't take that trade. You know, if you've got some of these blunt force ILW hedging needs where a state gets the job done, get the job done with state, right? Mm-hmm. Where I see something like county becoming more interesting is in those cases now where you've got a modeled approach to county, or if you're trying to shoehorn in qualifiers to get below state, enough's enough there. You know what? You have county level data now. Go do it right, you know, take some of the model risk out of the equation, fine. Dual triggers can be interesting, especially if you're looking at real geographic concentrations, especially like for elemental specialty risk. I think that could get really interesting. I think dual trigger could unlock more capital in underserved markets as well. So I've been talking to a lot of people about solar right now, and the three biggest states for solar facility implementation are California, Texas, and Florida. And what are the three things you normally see excluded from policies for solar in those areas? Wildfire, hail, tropical storm. Does not strike me as an accident. So, yeah, if we could find ways to bring in a wind, water, hail parametric, or kind of a wildfire that blends parametric with an industry loss qualifier, that gets really interesting. You know, if you trigger on wind speed, you've got kind of the Harvey style wet hurricane to worry about. If you trigger on like Cal Fire acreage, you do have basis risk issues that could creep in as well there. So what you find is that PCS cat designation or cat designation plus an industry loss of a certain size, tons of basis risk relative to an original insured, no question. But what you're doing is framing the event and saying, you know what? Yeah, this is big enough to matter, and then we throw in the parameter on top of that, that would be, you know, the determinant of payment. That sort of instrument's got a lot of potential. What we need to see right now is whether or not, you know, the original insurance market will take to parametrics. That I think it's one of those things in the industry that we've all thought for a long time, like, okay, this is a good idea, it's got some potential. And why isn't it happening, right? The latest issue right now is mostly around original risk manager budgets. You know, these guys are getting hit by pandemic. It's difficult economy right now. And, you know, what CFO is ever going to say, oh, yes, you should spend more on insurance right now. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got money laying around. You know, so as an industry, I think we often spend more time thinking about developing the product and kind of taking the sell side of this, right? And, you know, the reality is the buyers have the money.
Yeah.
And they don't have an endless amount of it. And selling insurance is not easy, right? I mean, you know, think about the insurance pitch within the context of an emerging market, like a microinsurance market. You know, you're going up to a guy and saying, hey, tell you what, give me some cash now. And if things go wrong, I'll totally be back later and give you a lot more. Yeah, the New Yorker in me doesn't like that pitch. And even with a sophisticated buyer like a corporate risk manager, you're still selling an intangible. And an intangible that if all goes well, you won't use. Mm. Pitch.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And actually what you were saying about dual triggers there and things like solar energy, it does make me wonder whether at some point, because the use of cat bonds and other ILS structures has kind of become as much to do with unlocking capacity as it has with sourcing protection for some of these sponsors. I do wonder whether somebody innovative who focuses on writing insurance business for those sorts of renewables and high exposure infrastructure classes of business could look to a weird and wonderful dual trigger cat bond structure or something to secure themselves long-term capital behind their underwriting.
Be interesting. That would be interesting. It's effort.
Yeah.
And what you need to make that effort worth it is, you know, a certain kind of critical mass around the buying community, which includes the education of that community actually, you know, taking hold.
Yeah. And right now we're in a market where there's so much liquidity generally in the financial markets that good underwriters with good ideas can raise money quite easily from equity investors whenever they want to. So I guess finally, to bring this to a close, wanted to talk to you a little bit about environmental, social governance, ESG factors, and just see sort of what your angle is on that. I know I saw an article recently that you'd written focused on ESG, and I guess that's something that's certainly on the agenda for the ILS market moving forward. So I thought it'd be interesting to hear your view there.
Yeah, it makes it, what I wonder with ESG is, could this become the biggest constraint on, well, not the biggest, right? Could this become a significant constraint on capital availability going forward? Especially with large pension funds increasingly requiring some sort of ESG angle. The reason I've been writing on it lately is because I've been getting calls about it. And they started 18 months ago. I mean, it's always been around, but people bringing it up directly, like, you know, the meeting environment, and at the end, one more thing, we need to talk about ESG. I don't know what to ask you, but anything you can do there would be great.
Yeah.
That started about 18 months ago, maybe a little less than that. And now the phone's ringing kind of affirmatively on ESG. Like, you know, hey, have you thought about, you know, identifying loss estimate components, you know, and breaking out the number by ESG favorable or unfavorable. You know, the notion that, you know, we're trading cat, so we've got a climate change angle there, don't worry about it. That's not as realistic as it was a couple of years ago. And when you look at the sorts of losses within these cats, well, the ESG story is not that good. You know, you take a look at Harvey, how much of that was auto?
Yeah.
You know, you're never going to sell that as ESG favorable. And electric cars is a portion of that. And in terms of ESG on the homeowner side, I mean, retrofitting homes, not that common. And then on the commercial part of a PCS loss, you know, just look at the impact of the Port Charles oil spill and Hurricane Laura estimate. You know, these are not favorable ESG components. And if you're to push to find out what is favorable within that, you're going to struggle. we're looking at ways to first distinguish, right? So on the large risk loss side, I like that for the ESP discussion because it's easy, right? Deepwater Horizon, Costa Concordia, Hammerfest, you know, these are pretty easy to identify. Lursen as a luxury yacht. These are easy to identify as not ESG. And, you know, we don't have a whole lot of experience with ESG losses yet because there isn't enough penetration. They aren't big enough. But you could develop a large risk portfolio or a large risk view on ESG versus non. And if you even wanted to go the extra mile, you could, within a cat loss, look at the large risk losses within that. You know, who are the standard serial offenders on ESG? Obviously, fossil fuel, you know, extraction, production, transport. Go a step further, transportation logistics, airlines, hotels. I mean, you don't often hear about environmentally friendly practices in hotels. So you can identify and segment out the bad pretty easily. You could score a loss on that basis. The real question is figuring out how to create the new market, right? So you look at the Lloyd's announcement recently to stop underwriting some fossil fuel risks by 2030, which in itself is fantastic. You look at 30 years of fossil fuel large risk losses, there's more than $60 billion worth of them in there out of $90 billion in large risk losses for that period. So, okay, so you take what's good for the environment. You can see a certain amount of common sense financially. But what you're missing is kind of a pivot point for that market. You know, you don't just leave a class of business without a plan for new revenue coming in unless that class of business is so profoundly unprofitable that you just leave. And it doesn't look like large risk is that way right now, despite some clear struggling in that market on the loss side. So what we need to figure out is how to, you know, get, you know, more insurance pushed to the likes of solar, which has structural issues around it as well, particularly, you know, cat exposure in the places where solar panels are most effective. So we really need to think roadmap-wise, not just about reducing the fossil side, which is important, but what we're going to do, how we're going to take the market and grow on a non-fossil basis. That requires data. That requires effort, creativity. But the good news is, you know, it is creating a new market, and creating a new market is always much better than trying to shave fractions of a basis point off your latest transaction.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting because it sounds like you're getting approached for assistance on ESG factors because the big allocators in that sector are just so keen to understand where essentially the payouts of insurance are going, and that's the bit they struggle with. This all comes back to our earlier discussion on transparency, really, as well. Interestingly, Lloyd's did say that they're going to try and bring in some transparency measures that flow through the entire market so that people have a better understanding of what lies beneath the different tiers of protection that go on there. That would be obviously a positive step. But yeah, it's a fascinating space and one that I'm sure as a data provider, you're going to find some demand coming through on. So, Tom, I really appreciate your time today. That was a good discussion. Gave us some insight into where your roadmap is going and what you see coming down the line. It does sound like there's going to be a lot of interesting activity going forwards that PCS will clearly be involved in. So thank you for your time today. As ever, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise, Steve. Thank you so much.